Disheartening news for employees of Environment Canada this week. The federal government announced that nearly 800 jobs will be eliminated in the coming months. That's approximately 11% of the agency's total workforce. Meteorologists, chemists, biologists, and engineers are among those losing their jobs. The Sierra Club called the move a blatant attack on Environment Canada, saying that it would leave the agency toothless, with weakened scientific capacity, and no enforcement capability. Opposition parties were also quick to condemn the move. The Liberals warned that cuts would result in a reduced ability to evaluate scientific issues, such as climate change and air and water quality, and could lead to less informed decision-making.
Environmental groups are taking the Alberta Utilities Commission to court over its interim approval for the expansion of a coal-fired power plant in Western Alberta. The two groups, Pembina Institute, a sustainable energy think tank, and EcoJustice, an environmental legal advisory, claim that it was illegal for the Alberta Regulatory Agency to approve the project without a public hearing. The groups say that the Commission fast-tracked the approval for the expansion of the Grand Cache-based power plant in an attempt to beat the federal government's deadline for new greenhouse gas regulations. The regulations come into effect after July 1, 2015, and apply to any new plants coming into service after this date. Maxim Power Corp., the company developing the power plant, said that it could only meet this deadline if the Commission approved the expansion by June 30th of this year. EcoJustice, formerly Sierra Legal Defense Fund, had previously sought a public hearing on the coal project, but was denied. The 500-megawatt expanded facility would produce 3 million tons of greenhouse gases per year. If the expansion was required to comply with future federal regulations, its greenhouse gas emissions would be cut nearly in half.
Protests over a controversial form of natural gas drilling, called hydraulic fracking, took place throughout Atlantic Canada this past week. Monday saw over 1,000 people converge on the New Brunswick legislature. Rallies were also held in Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island. Organizers said they want to send a message to the oil and gas industry that fracking should not be allowed. Hydraulic fracking uses pressure from fluids, which are pumped into the ground, to increase the recovery rate of oil and natural gas. Concerns over the technique focus mainly on the cocktail of chemicals used and uncertainty surrounding the impact on groundwater. In 2007, a pipeline in Prince Edward Island, which was being used for fracking, burst, spilling radioactive material. Currently, fracking is allowed in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, but not in Prince Edward Island. Studies are still being conducted into the environmental impacts of the process.
Changes in June to BC government hunting regulations permit unlimited hunting of wolves in a large area of BC's central interior. Prior to these changes, the typical bag limit was 3 wolves per person per year, but now there is no upper limit. The changes also increase the period for trapping on private land. Paul Paquette, senior scientist with the Rainforest Conservation Foundation, is troubled by these changes.
They essentially have declared war on wolves and are encouraging an indiscriminate slaughter of wolves.
Recent media attention has been on how regulations are intended to help ranchers manage cattle-killing wolves. But according to the BC government staff, there are other reasons as well, including concerns by some First Nations groups that deer and moose are being drastically reduced by a growing wolf population, as well as what may be the need for wolf culling as part of a recovery strategy for endangered mountain caribou in northern BC. Several non-government biologists say that there's not enough information about the wolf population in the region to allow unrestricted hunting, and that in the case of cattle predation, a large body of research has shown that such culling methods typically do not work, as they disrupt a wolf pack's social structure and allow for the intrusion into their territory of lone wolves, which are more likely than other wolves to prey on calves. Kevin Boone, general manager of BC Cattlemen's Association, says that cattle killed by wolves has increased dramatically in the past few years.
Our producers are can show us pretty good evidence where they're losing anywhere from 5 to somewhere up to 12 to 15% of their herd at their young calves on an annual basis.
British Columbia wolf populations are considered healthy, but as they represent the largest population of wolves in North America, they are of special importance to conservation of the species.
The pollution-prone southern portions of Ontario and Quebec have seen significantly less smog over the past summer. However, a closer look at the ultimate cause of this decrease in air pollution brings some disappointing news. The recession has slowed production in the manufacturing industry, resulting in a reduction in smog-creating emissions. Other suggested causes include favorable winds, which blow our pollution into the United States, the cumulative impacts of government regulations, and the recent closure of several coal-fired power plants. Nevertheless, these gains in environmental quality come as a relief to many, and the hope is that at least some of this breathing space can be maintained into the future. And that's it for your wrap-up of the week's news headlines. Back to you, Tasneem.
Thanks for the updates, Ian and Steve. For those just tuning in, you are listening to Terra Informa. We are proud to be broadcast across Canada on numerous campus and community radio stations. For more information about our show and to listen to past shows, you can visit us at terrainforma.ca. Last week, the University of Alberta's campus garden held an open house. We stopped by to take a look and caught up with Anna Vasala. Anna completed the City of Edmonton's 3-week Master Composter and Recycler program several years ago and now provides information about waste reduction at community events around the city. With gardening season in full swing, we thought it would be a great time for some tips on composting. Here's our correspondent, Steve Anderson, in conversation with Anna Vasala.
I guess when a lot of people think compost, the first thing that comes to mind, maybe not for everybody, but for a lot, is probably, you know, kind of a smelly, nasty, decomposing, God knows what, the sort of thing you end up with, you know, when you don't take out your kitchen garbage for a little too long. How accurate is that?
That's probably very accurate for a lot of people that, as you say, maybe don't take any active role in composting. I think there's a lot of misconception that that's all you have to do to compost, when in fact there is a little bit of work involved to actually make good quality compost, and in a relatively fast manner. You don't just want it to decompose on its own. You want to actually have some before the garden season is over.
And so I understand there's several different types of composter. Can you maybe describe the different options available to people?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest things to consider is how big is your yard? How much waste or how much organic waste are you producing? So someone with a very large yard that has a number of people in the house that are all producing a lot of food waste, they would probably want to look at a bigger composting system. So there's like a 3-compartment system, which would allow for at least 2 active composting, and then 1 as more of a storage or a holding bin for finished compost. And that can go, like, I would say that's the bigger version. The smaller version for an outdoor composting system would be just a 1-bin system where you put everything into only one little compartment, you harvest things from the bottom, and you can even go smaller than that and do indoor composting for apartments or condos or even workplaces or your office even. So it doesn't take nearly as much food waste as the larger outdoor systems, but it produces really high quality compost that you can put in your house plants or even just sprinkle on the lawn outside of your window to make it nice and green.
And if people are new to composting and they're just starting out, what are the main things that you'd say they need to know?
So there's 4 really important factors for composting to work well and without that smell that you were talking about. The first 2 are the active ingredients that you are adding into the compost. So the main thing that people think about for composting is their food waste. However, you also need a source of carbon material. So for microorganisms to decompose things in an effective manner, they need a source of carbon and they also need a source of nitrogen. So your nitrogen is all of your food scraps, all your green leafy matter, like garden clippings from the tops of potatoes and tomatoes and pea shells and carrot tops and all of that jazz. It's also including eggshells and any biodegradable matter. The carbon is coming from dead leaves, dry grass, perhaps even straw or like twigs and wood chips. So you need about a half and half mix of those 2 different types of materials for the microorganisms to break things down. So once you have that good combination, you also need to make sure there's air and moisture in your compost. The air is going to help you prevent smell in your compost. So if there is a lack of oxygen in your compost heap, it's going to go into anaerobic decomposition, which produces methane, which doesn't smell good at all. And everyone in your neighborhood will know when your compost bin isn't getting turned or doesn't have enough air in it. So just taking a pitchfork and fluffing up your compost pile and turning it over about once a week is a good rule of thumb. And the last thing is moisture, especially in the drier climates in the prairies. You want to make sure that you have added enough water onto your pile so that it's wet like a wrung-out sponge. So that's quite moist, actually. People are a little bit worried that they're over-watering their compost pile. But if it's too dry, you're going to attract mice and other rodents and also ants because they like that dry environment. So those four things, nitrogen, carbon, moisture, and air.
All right. So now that we have sort of a sense of what's involved in keeping the composter going and keeping it happy, what are the benefits to a person running a composter? Like, why would I want to set one up?
Well, we've heard here today from a few people that they are just more aware of how much garbage they produce or how much organic biodegradable waste they have in their household. So it's one really great way of noticing how much on an individual basis you are producing as your waste. I think that gets people thinking of how much they need to buy or how much they need to, you know, grab from the garden so that they're not taking more than they need. On the other end of things, once you have compost, it's an excellent source of nutrients and slow-release nutrients, whereas the fertilizers that people will buy in stores, they're a very quick release, and that's why they're so potent. Compost, on the other hand, is a slow-release nutrient, so it's not as likely to, like, burst into something and then see your plant die 2 weeks later when it's starving after that huge meal of store-bought fertilizer. Also, it makes the full cycle. So when you harvest some peas from the garden, you eat the peas, you throw your pea shells into the compost pile, those nutrients are going to break down that you can put back into the soil. So it's a really wonderful way to close that system of your waste. I think that's important for people to see.
And if folks want more information on setting up their own composter, where can they go?
The City of Edmonton has a great bunch of resources online. Specifically, the Waste Management Branch has a composting booklet on how to do it very simply. So just edmonton.ca/waste. And also the John Jansen Nature Centre has fantastic demonstration bins for different sizes and types of composting bins. And they also have staff there during the summer that can help you figure out what's going on with your compost bin or start you out.
Great. Well, thanks for telling us all about composting today, Anna.
Thank you, Steve, for that great report on composting. I think we all learned a thing or two. If you're interested in applying these tips in your local area, many municipalities provide information and resources for residents who are interested in composting. It cuts down on the amount of material that garbage collectors need to haul to the landfill, so it makes a lot of sense for cities to encourage the practice. Quite a few communities have also started curbside pickup of yard waste and household compost. To find out what services your city offers, contact your local waste management branch. If you are just joining us on the airwaves, you are listening to Terra Informa, a weekly environmental news program. You can connect with us on your social media, through Facebook or on Twitter. A briefing note written by Environment Canada for the Environment Minister, Peter Kent, revealed that Canada is falling behind the U.S. in cutting carbon emissions and is likely to fall short of its targets. This is nothing new for most observers of Canadian climate policy, but to hear it from a federal government department was alarming. Other countries, however, are moving ahead on climate policy. The Australian government has just released plans for a carbon tax, which would start next year. To find out how the Australian and Canadian approaches compare, we spoke with renowned Australian economist John Quiggin, who is also a columnist for the influential Australian Financial Review. Terra Informa correspondent David Karchin filed this report from Pittsburgh.
John Quiggin, great to have you on today's show. Thanks very much for joining us on Terra Informa.
Great to be here.
So if we can start with your native Australia, where there's been a recent major policy announcement with regard to action on climate change, can you describe what the government is proposing there?
The government's proposing to introduce a carbon tax at a rate of $23 a tonne, with the hope that that will merge into a global carbon trading scheme over the course of the next 5 to 10 years.
One thing we often hear in Canada is that there's no point taking action because our emissions are relatively small on a global scale. Is that an argument that's coming out in Australia? And if it is it one that you think holds much water?
Well, it's certainly an argument that's coming out. Both Australia and Canada account for several percent of global emissions, so our contribution isn't negligible. Or, of course, it doesn't mean that unilateral action can achieve the goal. But, of course, that's true essentially of everything Australia and Canada do internationally. If you look at, for example, the armed forces, we contribute to various international efforts around the world. Obviously, those are typically only 1 or 2 or 3% of the total commitment, and it's striking that the people making the argument that our contribution on climate change is too small to be taken account of seem to have very different views when it comes to military expenditure.
You're here in North America at the moment. Are you hearing much talk about what Australia is doing? In other words, is the rest of the world noticing what's going on?
There's certainly interest in what we're doing. We're, of course, like Canada, one of the countries that's vacillated back and forward on these issues. So for a long time, digging our heels in against action during the Bush administration and the Howard government in Australia, and then shifted to an attempt very much to punch above our weight with some success, then ran into domestic problems of a similar kind to those in Canada with very equivocal election outcomes. And now we're back with a narrow majority government introducing this carbon tax, and certainly people are interested to know how the debate's gone in Australia.
So it sounds like Australia is planning on taking some action regardless of recalcitrance in the US. In Canada, the argument from the federal government is that any action without prior action from the US would be deeply damaging to the economy. Is that an argument that you consider to be substantial?
No, I mean, I think you look at the numbers and we're talking about measures where the total revenue raised would be perhaps 1% of national income, the total net cost to the economy a tiny fraction of that. So these kinds of claims don't stand up to scrutiny. The effects of unilateral action at prices of $20 a tonne are really so small that the average household will barely notice them. And we're seeing the debates shift somewhat in Australia as we move from abstract debate to an actual policy proposal where the net impact is very small indeed.
I'll come back to some of those cost and benefit figures in a minute. But first of all, I know that you're a keen observer of international climate policy. Have we moved on from Copenhagen? And if so, where are we going?
Hard to say whether we've moved on. I mean, Cancun was somewhat more successful than Copenhagen, and I think certainly I think the Chinese in particular, who played the major spoiling role at Copenhagen, I think expected a very different international reaction to the one they got. Perhaps saw themselves both as boldly asserting national sovereignty and as some sort of third world leaders. Instead, they got painted as spoilers of the worst kind. So certainly we've seen, I think, a significant change in the attitude of the Chinese. On the other hand, of course, the political situation in North America has become much less favourable.
Let's talk about some numbers now, because you are an economist. Now, economists have tried to calculate costs and benefits of action on climate change. To what extent do the figures that economists are coming up with agree?
There's a reasonably good agreement on the mitigation side. We can certainly nail down the costs of the kind of mitigation we need for stabilisation. On the one hand, are substantial numbers in the tens of billions of dollars for economies like Australia and Canada, but on the other hand, small in relation to our national income as a whole. So typically, a very broad range would be an annual cost of typically 1 to 5% of national income. So that's sort of relatively easy to do. The cost of doing nothing globally is much harder to put a number on. And for many purposes, I think it's sufficient to observe that under any plausible accounting, destruction of natural ecosystems and sea level rise, those two factors are going to put you with numbers well above 5% of income, which then gives you a starting point to say that action globally is almost certainly beneficial.
And I guess because counting the economic costs of losing species is so difficult, it's quite easy to simply leave them out of the models and lead to estimates which many people might not agree with if they care about species' continual survival.
That's right, because it isn't really much discussed. The economists have had a lengthy technical dispute about discount rates, which is how much we should care about the future, but really issues like this haven't been adequately discussed. There isn't a good way of placing dollar values on these things other than, as I say, to say that you can look at any sort of plausible, to my mind, view and suggest, you know, the idea that we'd be better off wiping out most species on Earth than, for example, having a recession like the one we just had, which reduced national income by considerably more than 5%. The idea that, bad as it was, that this recent recession would be equivalent to a mass extinction, I just find totally implausible.
Sounds like it comes down to an ethical issue in some ways.
There is an ethical issue. I mean, if you're not convinced by that ethical argument, I think the second part is the low-risk disaster scenarios. I mean, when I say low-risk, if you look at the typical models of climate sensitivity, there's a 4 or 5% chance that even with seemingly ambitious targets like 550 parts per million, that we could see 4 or 5 degrees of warming, which would certainly have catastrophic effects on a wide range of human activities, including agriculture.
Okay, can I ask you about the European carbon market now? Is it working? Has it actually cut emissions in absolute terms?
Certainly they've hit their targets, which are a significant reduction in emissions on 1990 levels, and you can make some quibbles about that. The first is, of course, that the Europeans have picked a starting date which makes them look good. And the second is that a significant amount of EU emissions have been displaced by imports from China, and that was a factor which wasn't really taken into account. Nonetheless, the market really has worked pretty much as advertised, and indeed the lesson has been that compared to what was expected, the target was actually less ambitious than could have been realised. So the carbon price has been lower, and the macroeconomic impact has been so negligible as to be unobservable. So if you look at the discussion in North America or Canada, this is going to destroy the economy. Europe obviously has huge economic problems, but no one even mentions emissions trading scheme. Very clearly that isn't large enough to even appear on the radar. So I think the scheme, broadly speaking, has been successful.
And can you put a number on it? Do we know what the total reduction has been so far in carbon emissions from that 1990 baseline?
Their target, I believe, is a 20% reduction by 2020, and they're about to reach their 2012 target, which I can't call to mind immediately, but certainly managed, contrary to a great deal of speculation, managed to meet the target quite easily, and with carbon prices that have remained lower than would have been expected.
Okay. John, just a final question now. If you were talking to the Cabinet in Canada, in the federal government, and you were discussing climate policy, based on what Australia is proposing and the rationale for what Australia is proposing, what would you recommend to the Canadian government?
The basic answer is that we need a price on carbon. Now, it really is a matter of national circumstances whether you implement that through a tax or an emissions trading scheme or some hybrid of the two. But really, I think what will be seen is that once we introduce a relatively modest price on carbon, we'll see significant reductions in emissions. The kind of scare scenarios put forward by the opponents of carbon pricing, I think, have been shown in Europe to be false enough. The Australian numbers suggest the same will be true for us.
John Quiggin, it's been great to have you on the show on a really important and interesting topic. Thanks very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Next up, Terra Informa's Brett Taggart fills us in on new advances in orbital solar power and the benefits they could provide to all of us back here on the ground.
Diversity.
Automated metering infrastructure.
Natural energies.
Regulate CO2.
PM control strategies.
Natural resource exploitation.
Steady state.
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Uranium.
The Enhanced Oil Recovery.
Sustainable energy.
Ecobabble. Today we'll be examining a new method of gathering solar energy, one that could solve many of the complications with conventional land-based solar panels. Orbital solar panels have been around since the late 60s, powering the space station Skylab and Salyut, as well as the International Space Station. But transmitting the energy to Earth in useful quantities has been the realm of science fiction until quite recently. Now, with at least three competing firms that offer or are developing satellites that can transmit energy to power homes and offices, this radical new form of power generation could provide an alternate and reliable source of clean energy to meet our growing demands. The benefits of orbital solar power are substantial. As has been demonstrated on the International Space Station, orbital panels are virtually unaffected by the day and night cycles of the sun. On the planet's surface, solar panels can only collect energy for a maximum of about 9 hours a day, given clear skies. On cloudy days, or in far north latitudes such as we live in, little to no solar energy can be absorbed during poor conditions. Orbital solar power can be collected and transmitted 24 hours per day, This allows solar energy to provide baseload electricity, the 24-hour constant electricity that is needed for everything from hospitals to refrigerators, and is usually provided by coal or nuclear plants. Environmental wear on panels is dramatically reduced when in space. No snow, wind, or dirt can cloud the panels or damage electrical connections. Orbital hazards are relatively few. Micrometeorite or debris impacts are dangerous but rare. The International Space Station, with its massive 100-foot solar panels, has needed very little maintenance over its 15-year lifespan. Transmitting the energy gathered in space back to the surface is an interesting challenge, but conceals one of the greatest strengths of the technology. Because the microwave beam orbital satellites used to transfer energy can be easily unfocused and focused again at another point on the globe, one satellite can provide power as needed to cities hundreds of miles apart. Orbital power transmission could provide electricity to far-flung northern settlements, provide emergency power to relieve urban blackouts, and help in disaster relief efforts. The microwaves used to transmit power do so via the radio spectrum, the same transmissions that carry FM radio and cell phone signals. A typical satellite emits a continuous beam that, at its core, is about 3% as intense as a microwave oven. Biological tests have shown a complete lack of interference with living creatures, including no effects even in the long term on birds or honeybees. These satellites could never be used as a laser death ray from the sky out of a spy movie. Any weaponized energy transfer would have to be far more powerful and over a much shorter range. Recent technology developments allow satellites to use generated electricity to maintain orbit, eliminating refueling trips, and other advancements allow multiple small satellites to cooperate to send one energy beam to the surface, making the network easier to construct and more redundant to satellite failure. This, combined with new commercial space ventures using cheap, reusable space vehicles, has led California's SolarEN Corp. to sign a contract promising a 200-megawatt satellite array in operation by 2016, producing roughly half the energy of a fossil fuel plant. The government of Japan is also getting on board with ambitious plans for a 1-gigawatt satellite array by 2030, predicting very affordable energy, about 6 times cheaper than nuclear power. If orbital solar power works, it could change everything. 24-hour power, where it's needed, is an incredible boon to industrialized and developing economies. Its operation produces no pollution, just like ground-based solar cells, and could virtually halt the use of coal for electricity generation. The sun sends more energy towards us than humans have ever used through the history of civilization every second. This is the easiest way to use it.
And that was Brett Taggart with a favorite from the Terra Informa archives. That wraps up this week's episode of Terra Informa. Thank you for joining us. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode jam-packed with cutting-edge feature environmental reports. If you are missing us on the airwaves during the week, remember you can find us online at terrainforma.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @terra_informa or become friends with us on Facebook. Until next week, I've been your host, Tasneem Karbani. Remember to keep it green and stay informed.
Hello, and welcome to Terra Informa, your weekly source for news on the Canadian environment. I'm Ian McKenzie, and I'll be guiding you through this week's blue-themed show. Like me, you may have been feeling good about the environmental benefits of switching from plastic to cloth grocery bags. No longer will a bag that I use for my groceries be responsible for choking a hungry sea turtle or any other environmental tragedy. However, this week's first feature story, I'm sorry to say, may give you something new to feel bad about when visiting a grocery store. In this episode of Terra Informa, David Hodgson speaks to sociologist and author Michael Carolyn about the hidden and environmental social costs associated with seemingly inexpensive food. And still on the topic of food, the second feature story of this show, Steve Anderson's voice heads north by telephone fiber optic to talk with local subsistence hunters living in the Northwest Territories.
The hunters provide their perspective on the health of caribou populations in the region and their thoughts on what may be causing a decline in the caribou's numbers. But before we get to the features, joining me for this week's news roundup is Rebecca Rooney.
To start things off, I have a story from the Arctic, where climate change is literally creating a blast from the past. A new study, published in the prestigious journal Nature Climate Change, suggests that warming in the high north has been releasing pollutants which have been frozen in the ice for many years. Many of these pollutants, called persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, are notorious both because of their toxicity and their ability to accumulate in food and water supplies over time.